fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 5 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, The Roundup. "I had a letter from Wainwright in the mail today, Di," said Elias Henders to his daughter about a week later. "He's after me again to put a price on the whole shebang." "We could go east and live then, couldn't we?" asked the girl. Henders looked at her keenly. There had been just the tiniest trace of wistfulness in her tone. He crossed the room and put an arm about her. "You'd like to go east and live?" he asked. "I love it here, Dad, but there is so much there that we can never have here. I should like to see how other people live. I should like to go to a big hotel, and to the theaters and opera, and meet educated people of my own age. I should like to go to parties where no one got drunk and shot the lights out," she concluded with a laugh. "We don't have to sell out to go back," he told her. "I'm afraid I've been selfish, because I never wanted to go back after your mama left us. I forgot that you had a right to the same advantages that she and I enjoyed. The ranch seemed enough, the ranch and you." "But there'd be no one to manage things if you went away," she insisted. "Oh, that could be arranged. I thought you felt that we couldn't afford to go unless we sold." "It would be nice if you were relieved of all responsibility," she said. "If you sold the ranch and the brand, you wouldn't have to worry about how things were going here." "Old Wainwright wouldn't pay what they are worth, even if I was ready to sell," he explained. "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make him a price. If he takes it, I'll sell out. And anyway, whether he does or not, we'll go east to stay, if you like it." "What price are you going to ask?" $750,000 for the ranch and the brand. They might bring more if I wanted to make an effort to get more, but that will show a fair profit for us, and I know will be satisfactory to John. He has asked me a dozen times in his letters why I didn't sell the cattle end of the business and come east. "Yes, I know Uncle John has always wanted us to come back," she said. "But old Wainwright really doesn't want the ranch and cattle at all," said her father. "What he wants is the mine. He has offered me $1 million for all our holdings in the county, including the mine. He mentions the fact that the workings have pretty near petered out, and he's right. And he thinks I'll grab at it to unload. I suspect he's had a man up there for the past 6 months, the new bookkeeper that Corson sent out while your Uncle John Mantle was in Europe. And he thinks he's discovered something that I don't know, but I do. For years, Di, we've been paralleling a much richer vein than the one we've been working. I've known it for the past 2 years. But John and I figured we'd work out the old one first. We've all the money we need, anyway. The mine alone is worth 10 or 20 millions. "Uncle John knows it? There wouldn't be any danger that someone might trick him into a deal?" "Not a chance. And of course, as you know, he wouldn't do anything without consulting me. Ours is rather a peculiar partnership, Di, but it's a very safe one for both of us. There isn't a scratch of a pen between us as far as any written agreement is concerned, but he trusts me and I trust him. Why, before either of us married, the only precautions we took to safeguard our interests was to make our wills. I left everything to him, and he left everything to me. After we married, we made new wills, that was all. If I die first, everything goes to him, and when he dies, it is all divided equally between our surviving heirs, or just the other way around if he dies first. Each of us felt that we could thus best safeguard the interests of our respective families, since we both had implicit confidence in the other's honesty and integrity." "Oh, let's not talk about it," exclaimed the girl. "Neither one of you is ever going to die." "All right, Di," laughed her father. "Just as you say, you've always had your own way. Now we'll plan that eastern trip. Can't very well go until after the spring roundup, and in the meantime we can be sizing up Colby. If he takes hold all right, we couldn't do better than to leave him in charge. I never did like the idea of importing a new man as superintendent if you could possibly use one of your own men. What do you think of him, Di?" "I don't know yet, Dad," she replied. "I like him immensely, and I think he's honest and loyal, but he don't know stock, nor the range, as well as Bull." "Bull is out of the question," replied her father. "I could never trust him again." "I know how you feel. I feel the same way. And yet there's something about him, Dad. I can't explain it. But when I'm with him, I cannot doubt him."
"He's got you hypnotized. I hope he hasn't been making love to you," he concluded seriously.
"Oh, they all do," she cried, laughing, "but Bull least of all. I suppose you'll have to be marrying one of these days, and if you were going to live here, I'd rather you married a Western boy. But if you are going east, you mustn't fall in love yet, for you are sure to find a great difference between the boys you have known and the boys back there." Don't worry, Dad. I haven't fallen in love yet. But if I do soon, I'm afraid it's going to be either Hal Colby or Jefferson Wainwright. Senior? He asked. Oh, isn't he funny and impossible? She cried. He's all of that and more, too, replied her father. What do you mean? I mean that I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw a bull by the tail. He's one of those blue-bellied Yankees who considers any means as honest that'll keep him on the right side of a jail door, but the boy appears to be a much more decent sort. He is delightful and wonderful, said Diana. The days passed, lovely sunshiny days, during which Diana spent long hours dreaming of the coming Eastern trip. She rode much, as usual, sometimes with one man, again with another, but more often with her father or Hal Colby. Bull's assignments usually took him too far afield for her to accompany him. If he thought that Colby had some such purpose in mind when he laid out the work from day to day, he said nothing of it. But he could not have failed to notice that following each of the few occasions upon which Diana accompanied him, usually a Sunday, he was given work the next day that kept him in the saddle until late at night, and upon several occasions away from the ranch for 2 days or more. At last the time of the spring rodeo arrived. Riders from other outfits commenced straggling in, some from 100 miles away, until the Bar Y Ranch commenced to take on the appearance of an army camp. The chuck wagon was overhauled and outfitted. The Cavy was brought over from the West Ranch, wild, half-broken horses, with a sprinkling of colts that had never felt leather, and assigned to the riders. There were enough to give each man a string of 8 horses. With the others came Jefferson Wainwright, Jr., arrayed like Solomon. At first the men had a lot of fun with him, but when he took it good-naturedly they let up a bit, and after a few evenings, during which he sang and told stories, they accepted him almost as one of them. He was much with Diana Henders, with the result that he found himself with 4 unbroken broncs in his string. The Bar Y hands grinned when Colby picked them for him, and everyone was present when he first essayed to ride one of them. Diana was there, too. She chanced to be standing near Bull when the first of the 4, having been roped, thrown, and hogtied, was finally saddled, bridled, and let up. It was a ewe-necked, wall-eyed, Roman-nosed pinto, and its back was humped like a camel's. "He sure looks mean," remarked Bull to the girl. "They ought not to let Mr. Wainwright ride him," she replied. "He's not used to bad horses, and he may be killed."
"I reckon that's just about how Hal figured it," said Bull. "I didn't think it of him. It's a shame," she exclaimed. "Someone ought to top that horse for Mr. Wainwright. Someone who can ride, like you, Bull," she added flatteringly. "You want me to?" he asked. "I don't want to see the poor man killed."
Bull stepped forward and climbed into the corral. Wainwright was standing several feet from the pinto, watching several men who were trying to readjust the blind over the brute's eyes. Bull saw that the man was afraid. "Want me to top him for you, young feller?" he asked. "Don't you think he's safe?" asked Wainwright. "Oh, yes, he's safe, like a Kansas cyclone." Wainwright grinned a sickly grin. "I'd appreciate it," he said, "if you'd try him first. I'll be glad to pay you for your trouble." Bull approached the men with the horse. "Lead him out," he said. "When I rides one like that, I wants elbow room." They ran the pony, bucking, out of the corral. Bull stepped to the animal's side.
"What you doin'?" demanded Colby, who had been standing too far away to overhear the conversation.
"Toppin' this one for the dude," replied Bull.
"No, you're not," snapped Colby. His voice was angry. "You'll ride the hosses I tells you to, and so will he."
"I'm ridin' this one," replied Bull. He had grasped the cheek strap with his left hand. His right was on the horn of the saddle. Carefully he placed his left foot in the stirrup. Then he nodded to a man standing at the horse's head. The blind was snatched away, and the man leaped aside. The horse reared, wheeled, and struck at Bull, but Bull was not there. He was in the saddle. The animal lunged forward awkwardly once, then he gathered himself, stuck his nose between his front feet, and went to pitching, scientifically and in earnest, and as he pitched he lunged first to the right and then to the left, twisting his body, squealing and kicking. Bull waved his sombrero and slapped the beast on neck and rump with it, and the pinto bucked the harder. Finding that these tactics failed to unseat the rider, he commenced suddenly to turn end for end in air at each jump. Yet still the man stuck, until the beast, frantic with combined terror and rage, stopped in his tracks and turned savagely to bite at Bull's legs. Just a moment of this until he felt the sting of the quirt, and then he reared quickly and threw himself over backward in an effort to crush his rider. Nor did he miss him by a matter of more than inches. There are those who will tell you just how you should throw yourself safely to one side when a horse falls. But any man who has had a horse fall with him, or deliberately throw himself backward, knows that it is 5 parts chance and the rest luck if he isn't caught. And so it was just luck that Bull fell clear. Diana Henders felt a sudden lump in her throat, and then she saw the horse scramble to his feet, and the rider, too, just in time to throw a leg across the saddle and come up with a firm seat and both feet in the stirrups. The quirt fell sharply, first on one flank and then on the other. The pinto took a dozen running jumps and then settled down to a smooth run across the open. 5 minutes later he came loping back, blowing and sweaty, still trembling and frightened, but with the hump out of his back.
You can ride him now, said Bull to young Wainwright, as he dismounted carefully and stood stroking the animal's neck. Hal Colby came forward angrily, but Bull had dismounted close to where Diana Hender stood, and it was she who spoke to him first, and Colby, approaching, heard her words. "Thank you ever so much, Bull," she said. "I was sorry afterwards that I asked you to ride him, for I thought you were going to be hurt when he threw himself. I should never have forgiven myself."
"Shucks," said Bull, "it wasn't nothing."
Colby walked off in another direction. If there had been bad blood between the two men in the past, it had never been given outward expression, but from that moment Colby made little or no effort to hide the fact that he had no use for Bull, while the latter in many little ways showed his contempt for the foreman. Better friendships than had ever existed between these two have been shattered because of a woman, but there were other exciting causes here. That Colby had gotten Bull's job might have been enough to cause a break, while the foreman's evident suspicion that Bull knew a great deal too much about the holdups in Hell's Bend and the shooting of Mac Harbor would have turned even more generous natures than Hal Colby's against the ex-foreman. In spite of herself, Diana Henders could not deny a feeling of chagrin that Jefferson Wainwright had permitted another man to top a bad horse for him, although it had been she who had arranged it. Perhaps she was a trifle cool to the young Easterner that evening, but she thawed gradually beneath the geniality of his affable ways and entertaining conversation, and in the weeks that followed, during which she accompanied the outfit throughout the roundup, she was with him much of the time, to the great discomfiture of Hal Colby and others. The Bar Y foreman had, however, after the day that Bull rode the Pinto for Wainwright, left the latter severely alone, for the following morning Elias Henders had come to the corral and selected a new string of horses for the dude, and spoken a few words in the ear of his foreman. The long, hard days in the saddle left them all ready to turn in to their blankets soon after supper. A smoke, a little gossip and rough banter, and the men jingled away through the darkness in search of their bedrolls to the accompaniment of their tinkling spurs. "I seen Injun signs today," remarked a tall, thin Texan one evening. "About a dozen of 'em been camping over yonder a piece in them hills. Signs weren't over 4 hour old."
"They might be peaceable Injuns on pass from the reservation," suggested another.
"More likely they're renegades," said Shorty. "Anyhow, I ain't a-takin' no chances on no Injuns. I shoots fust and axes for their pass later."
"You ain't never seed a hostile Injun, Shorty," said Texas Pete.
"A lot you knowed about it, you sawed-off, hammered-down, squint-eyed horse thief," retorted Shorty courteously. "I'm a bad man with Injuns."
"By gollies," exclaimed Pete, "that reminds me of another verse.
So bring on your bad men, your killers and sich, and send out some greasers to dig me a ditch. For when I gets through, if I takes any pains, you'll need a big hole for to plant the remains."
On the opposite side of the chuck wagon, where a tent had been pitched for Diana Henders, a little group surrounded her fire. Beside the girl, there were her father, Hal Colby, and Jefferson Wainwright, Jr. The two young men always gravitated in Diana's direction when off duty. Colby had been quick to realize the advantage that the other's education gave him, and bright enough to remain a silent observer of his manners and conversation. Inwardly he held the Easterner in vast contempt, yet he cultivated him and often rode with him that he might learn from him something of those refinements which he guessed constituted the basis of Diana's evident liking for Wainwright. He asked him many questions, got him to talk about books, and made mental note of various titles with the determination to procure and read the books that he heard the man discuss with Diana. Bull, on his part, kept away from the Henders fire in the evening, and in the daytime Colby saw to it that his assignment sent him far afield from where there was much likelihood of Diana being, with the result that he saw less of her than was usual at home. The ex-foreman's natural reserve had degenerated almost to sullenness. He spoke seldom and never smiled, but he rode hard and did his work well, until he came to be acknowledged as the best all-round man in the outfit. There was no horse that he wouldn't ride, no risk that he wouldn't take, no work that he would ever refuse, no matter how unfair the assignment, with the result that the men respected him, though there were none who seemed to like his company, with the exception of Texas Pete.
"Well, boys," said Elias Henders, rising, "I guess we'd better be turning in. Tomorrow's going to be a hard day."
The two younger men rose, Colby stretching and yawning. "I reckon you're right, Mr. Henders," he agreed, but waiting for Wainwright to make the first move to leave. The latter paused to roll a cigarette, an accomplishment that he had only recently brought to a state even approximating perfection. He used both hands and was rather slow. Colby eyed him, guessing that he was merely fighting for time in order to force the foreman to go first. Slowly the latter withdrew his own pouch of tobacco from his shirt pocket.
"Reckon I'll roll a smoke by the light of your fire, Di, before I go," he remarked.
He creased the paper, poured in a little tobacco, and, as he drew the pouch closed with his teeth and left hand, deftly rolled the cigarette with his right, bending it slightly in the center to keep it from opening up. Wainwright realized that if he had a conversational advantage over Colby, there were other activities in which the foreman greatly outshone him.
Rolling a smoke was one of them, and that was doubtless why Colby had chosen to roll one at the moment that odious comparison might be made. Wainwright lifted his and shifted to the other foot. Would Colby never leave? Colby permitted 3 matches to burn out before he finally succeeded in getting a light, thus gaining a considerable advantage in time over Wainwright. Elias Henders had repaired his blankets, just beyond Diana's tent and out of sight. The girl realized the game that the 2 men were playing, and could scarce repress an inclination to laughter. She wondered which would win, or if she would have to call it a draw and send them both about their business. Wainwright decided the matter. "Come on, Colby," he said, throwing an arm about the other's shoulders. "We're keeping Miss Henders up. Good night, Miss Henders." And raising his hat, he moved off, taking Colby with him. They had taken about 20 steps when Wainwright halted and wheeled about. "Oh, I say, Miss Henders," he called. "There's something I wanted to ask you," and he started back. "Don't wait for me, Colby," he threw over his shoulder. "I'll be along in a moment." Colby glared at the others retreating back through the darkness, hurled his cigarette to the ground, and stamped away, outgeneraled. "I'll get him yet," he mumbled. "He may be pretty slick at them parlor tricks, but they ain't many parlors in Arizona, the damn dude." Wainwright rejoined Diana by the fire. "It's too beautiful an evening to go to bed," he said, "and I haven't had half a chance to talk with you. Colby hangs around as though he had a mortgage on your time and was going to foreclose. He sort of puts a damper on conversation unless it revolves about cows. That's all he can talk about." "It's a subject that's always of interest to us out here," replied the girl loyally. "Cows are really our lives, you know." "Oh, that's all right for men, but there are other things in life for a girl like you, Miss Henders. You deserve something better than cows and cowboys. You love music and books, and you can't deny that you like to talk about them. You belong east. You belong back in Boston." "We're going back, not to Boston, but to New York, after the roundup, Dad and I," she told him. "No, really? How funny. I've got to go back, too. Maybe we could all go together." "That would be fine," she agreed. "Wouldn't you like to stay back there?" he asked, almost excitedly, and then quite unexpectedly he took her hand. "Miss Henders," he exclaimed. "Diana, wouldn't you like to stay there always? I'd make a home for you there. I'd make you happy. I love you, Diana. We could be married before we left. Wouldn't it be wonderful, going back there together on our honeymoon? And then to Europe. We could travel everywhere. Money would mean nothing. I don't have to tell you how rich we are." "No," she replied. "I have heard your father mention it," and withdrew her hand from his. He did not seem to notice the allusion to his father's boastfulness. "Tell me that you love me," he insisted. "Tell me that you will marry me." "But I don't know that I do love you," she replied. "Why, I scarcely know you, and you certainly don't know me well enough to know that you would want to live with me all the rest of your life." "Oh, yes, I do," he exclaimed. "If there was only some way to prove it. Words are so futile. They cannot express my love, Diana. Why, I worship you. There is no sacrifice that I would not willingly and gladly make for you or yours. I would die for you, dear girl, and thank God for the chance." "But I don't want you to die for me. I want you to go to bed and give me a chance to think. I have never been in love. Possibly I love you and do not know it. There is no need for haste, anyway. I will give you my answer before I go east. Now run along like a good boy." "But tell me, darling, that I may hope," he begged. "You will do that anyway, if you love me," she told him, laughingly, as she turned and entered her tent. "Good night." End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 6. The Renegades. The next morning, Colby took Wainwright with him. Deep in the foreman's heart was a determination to ride hard over the roughest country he could find, and if the dude got killed, it wouldn't be Colby's fault, nor would it be Colby's fault if he didn't. But the foreman's plans were upset at the last moment by Elias Henders and Diana, who elected to accompany him. "You and Wainwright ride ahead, Hal," directed Henders, "and Di and I will trail along behind." The foreman nodded silently and put spurs to his pony, and in silence Wainwright loped at his side. The arrangement suited neither, and each was busy concocting schemes whereby the other might be paired off with Elias Henders, though under ordinary circumstances either would have been highly elated at the prospect of spending a whole day in company with the old man. "Glorious morning," ejaculated Henders to his daughter. "God may have forgotten Arizona in some respects, but he certainly remembered to give her the most wonderful mornings in the world." "Don't they fill one with the most exquisite sensations?" she exclaimed. "Almost as intoxicating as wine," he agreed. And then, "By the way, Bull's been doing fine, hasn't he? I don't believe he's touched a drop since that night at Gum's."
"He's working hard, too," said the girl.
"He always did that. He's the best cowhand I ever saw, and a hog for work. There isn't a man in 7 counties that can commence to touch him when it comes to riding, roping, parting, calling brands, judging ages or weights, or handling cattle with judgment under any conditions, nor one that knows the range within 100 miles like he does.
Why, day before yesterday, he had to give a fellow from the Red Butte County some pointers about the fellow's own range. Bull knew it better than he did.
He's wonderful, said Diana. I love to see him in the saddle, and anywhere in the cow country he fits into the picture. I'm always proud that Bull is one of our men. Oh, I hope he don't ever drink again.
Elias Henders shook his head. I'm afraid he'll never quit, he said. A man's got to have something to quit for, and Bull has no incentive to stop, only just his job. And when did a little thing like a job keep a man from drinking, especially the best cowhand in the territory? There isn't an outfit anywhere that wouldn't hire him, drunk or sober. He don't seem to be hanging around you much lately, Di, and I'm glad of that. I'd hate to see you interested in a man like Bull. I don't take much to garrulous people, but neither do I want him as tight-mouthed as Bull. I'm afraid he's got something to hide that makes him afraid to talk for fear he'll let it out.
What do you suppose happened last night, Dad? Asked Diana suddenly.
I don't know, I'm sure. What? He asked.
Jefferson Wainwright proposed to me.
No. What did you tell him?
What should I have told him?
That depends upon how much or little you think of him, replied her father.
Would you like him for a son-in-law?
If you choose him, I shall like him. I should like the devil if you chose to marry him.
Well, he isn't quite as bad as all that, is he? She cried, laughing.
I didn't mean it that way. He seems to be a nice boy. He could give you everything, and he could take you among the sort of people that you belong among, and you wouldn't have to be ashamed of him, but I don't like his father.
His father is something of an embarrassment, she assented.
Do you love the boy, Di? He asked.
I don't know, and I told him so. He wants me to marry him before we go east, and all go together.
What a lovely idea, taking your father's on a honeymoon. You can count me out, and anyway, if some other man is going to take you east, I won't have to go at all.
Well, I haven't gone with him yet. I told him I'd give him his answer before we left.
That would be a good idea. If he's going, he might want a few minutes' notice, he bantered. But how about Hal? I thought you leaned a little in that direction.
I do, laughed the girl. When I'm with one, I like that one the best. And when I'm with the other, I like him.
And when they are both with you at the same time, possibly you can find your answer there.
I have thought of that, because then I always compare the two, and Hal always suffers by the comparison. That is, when we are sitting talking, but when they are in the saddle, it is the other way around.
People can't spend their married lives in the saddle, he reminded her.
She sighed. I am terribly perplexed. Of only one thing I am sure, and that is that I shall marry either Hal Colby or Jefferson Wainwright.
Or someone else, he suggested.
No, no one else, she stated emphatically. It was past noon, and they had turned back, gathering up the little bunches of cattle that they had driven down out of the canyon and coolly onto the flat below. Elias Henders and Diana were riding quite apart from the foreman and Wainwright when Henders turned back to ride to the summit of a low elevation for a final survey of the country for any straggling bunch that might have escaped their notice. Diana was a few yards in rear of him as he drew rein on top of the hillock. It was very quiet. The cattle were at a distance from them, moving slowly off down the valley. There was only the sound of her horse's unshod hooves in the soft dirt and the subdued noise of a well-worn saddle as she urged her mount toward the side of her father. Suddenly there was a crack of a rifle, and Elias Henders' horse dropped in its tracks. Henders fell clear and whipped out his revolver.
"Get out of here, Di," he called to the girl. "It's Indians.
You've got time if you keep behind this butte and ride like hell." She turned and looked toward the two men a quarter of a mile away, Colby and Wainwright. She saw them wheel their horses and look toward the point from which the shot had come, and from their position she guessed that they could see the Indians, though she could not. Then she saw Hal Colby put spurs and quirt to his mount until the wiry beast fairly flew over the ground toward her. Wainwright hesitated, looked toward the Indians, and then back down the valley in the direction of the camp 15 miles away. Suddenly he wheeled his horse and dashed off. To her mind flashed the impassioned words that he had poured into her ears only the night before.
"I worship you. There is no sacrifice that I would not willingly and gladly make for you and yours. I would die for you, dear girl, and thank God for the chance."
Her lip curled, and her eyes shot a single scornful glance in the direction of the retreating figure of Jefferson Wainwright before she turned them back toward Colby.
How magnificent he was! He had drawn one of his 6 guns and was riding, not for the hill, but straight for the Indians, and just as he passed out of her sight behind the hillock, he opened fire.
She could hear the crack of his gun mingling with those of the Indians, and then her father, pausing in his fire, turned to her again.
"My God, Di, haven't you gone?" he cried. "Hurry, there is time yet. Hal's got him on the run now, but they'll be back again. There must be a dozen of them. Ride back to camp for help."
"Mr. Wainwright has already gone, Dad," she told him. "We have always been together, all my life, Dad, and it don't take two to get help. We need all the guns here we can get until the boys come." And she dismounted and crawled to his side, despite his protests. Over the crest of the hill she could see Colby galloping toward them, while the Indians, a quarter of a mile beyond them, were just circling back in pursuit. In the foreground a dead Indian lay sprawled in the open. To the right a riderless pony was loping away to join its fellows.
Diana lay a few feet from her father, both in readiness to cover Colby's retreat when the Indians came within revolver range. "Wish we had a couple of rifles," remarked Elias Henders. "If I had a 30-30, I could hold them off alone until the boys get here." "We ought to be able to hold out for an hour, Dad. The boys should be here in that time."
"We'll do the best we can, but, Di," he paused, a little catch in his voice, "don't let them get you, dear. The boys might not get here in time. Wainwright is not much of a rider. He won't make the time that one of our boys would. They'd kill the horse, but they'd get there. And then there may not be anyone in camp but the cook that time of day. That's what I'm really most afraid of."
"We'll do the best we can. Likely as not, we'll pull through. But if we don't, why, remember what I said. Don't let them get you. Save one shot, you understand?"
"I understand, Dad."
Colby, his horse stretched to quirt and spur, swung around to their side of the hill, threw his horse to its haunches as he reined in close to them and leaped from the saddle. Without a word, he dragged the blowing, half-winded animal directly in front of them, raised his six-shooter to its forehead, and shot it between the eyes. Diana Henders voiced a little gasp of dismay, and then she saw the man turn toward her own pony, but she only covered her eyes with her palms and bit her lip to stifle a sob. A moment later there was a shot and the sound of a falling body. "Crawl behind that cayuse of mine, Di," said Colby. He was tugging at the body of the girl's pony to drag it closer to the others, in order to form a rude triangle with the two other dead horses. Henders rose to his knees and gave Colby a hand, while Di opened fire upon the approaching braves. "Reckon we ought to hold out here till the boys come," remarked the foreman. He was cool and self-possessed, just as cool and self-possessed as Jefferson Wainwright would have been in a Boston drawing room. Even as she took aim at a half-naked, yelling buck and missed him, Diana Henders' mind was considering this fact. She fired again, and this time the buck ceased to yell, grasped his stomach with both hands, and toppled headlong to the ground. Hal Colby might learn to be cool and self-possessed in a Boston drawing room, but could Jefferson Wainwright ever learn to be cool and self-possessed inside a yelling circle of painted savages thirsting for his life's blood? The Indians were now riding a wide circle entirely about the hillock, firing as they rode. Naturally, their aim was execrable, and the three were in danger only of a chance hit. After the warrior fell to Diana's bullet, the circle widened to still greater proportions, and a few minutes later the Indians withdrew out of effective revolver range and gathered in a compact group where the three on the hillock could see them gesticulating and talking excitedly. "They're up to some new devilment," said Henders. "I hope they don't charge from different directions before the boys get here," remarked Colby. "If they do, we might as well kiss ourselves goodbye. I wish you wasn't here, Di." "Damn that white-livered dude's hide. If he hadn't turned tail, you could have gone. You could ride rings around that slab-sided maverick, and besides, you'd have been safe. Look, they're separating now."
"Yes, they're riding to surround us again," said Diana. "If they charge, Hal," said Henders, "wait until they get close, and then stand up and let them have it. Di, you lie as close to the ground as you can. Don't move. Just watch us, and when you see we're both down, you'll know it's all up, and you must do what I told you to."
Hal Colby looked at the beautiful girl at his side, and scowled, for he guessed without being told what her father meant. "Damn that dude," he muttered. "Maybe I hadn't ought to shot all the horses," he said presently. "Maybe Di could have got away."
"No," Henders assured him. "You did just right, Hal. Di wouldn't go. I told her to, but she wouldn't. It was too late then, anyway."
"I figured it was too late," said Colby, "but maybe it wasn't. I wish I had that damn dude here."
"They're coming," cried Diana. From four sides, the Indians were racing towards them, their savage cries breaking hideously the silence of the sun-parched valley. The three crouched, waiting. No word was spoken until the nearest of the Redskins was no more than 25 yards away. Then, "Now," said Henders, leaping to his feet. Colby was up simultaneously, firing as he rose. Diana Henders, far from lying close to the ground as she had been directed, was on her feet almost as quickly as the men. "Get down, Di," commanded her father, but her only reply was a shot that brought down a warrior's pony 20 paces from them. Colby and Henders had each shot an Indian, and there was another pony down in front of Colby. The renegades were close now and presented splendid targets for the three whites, all of whom were excellent revolver shots. At each report of their weapons, a hit was scored. Now a pony screamed and wheeled away, bearing its rider in headlong flight down the gentle declivity of the hillside. Another stumbled and crumpled to the ground, sprawling its painted master in the dust. A warrior, wounded, veered to one side and raced off to safety, or again, one slumped silently to earth, never to charge again. Two of the unhorsed warriors sprang in close quarters, clubbing their empty rifles. One was leaping toward Diana, the other for Colby. At the same instant, Elias Henders lifted both hands above his head, his gun slipped from nerveless fingers, and he lunged forward across the body of his dead horse. Colby put a shot through the stomach of the buck leaping upon him, and then turned toward Diana. He saw the painted face of a tall chief just beyond Diana's.
He saw the rifle swinging to brain her as she pulled the trigger of her Colt with the muzzle almost against the sweat-streaked body. There was no answering report. And then, Colby, leaping between them, seized the upraised rifle and tore it from the hand of the red man. The two clinched, the Indian reaching for his knife, while the white, who had emptied both guns and had no time to reload, strove to brain his antagonist with one of them. Struggling, they fell. Diana Henders, reloading her own weapon, looked hurriedly about. The other warriors, momentarily dispersed, had rallied and were returning with wild, triumphant yells, for they saw that the battle was already theirs. Elias Henders raised himself weakly on one elbow and looked about. Instantly, his gaze took in the situation.
"Die," he cried. "My little girl. Quick. Don't wait. Shoot yourself before they get you."
"Not yet," she cried, and turned toward the two men, the red and the white, battling at her feet. Stooping, she held the muzzle of her weapon close to the rolling, tossing men, waiting an opportunity to put a bullet in the chief when she could do so without endangering Colby. From behind her, the returning braves were approaching rapidly, the racing hooves of their ponies pounding a dull tattoo on the powdery earth. They were almost upon her when Colby's fingers found the chief's throat and the latter's head was pushed momentarily away from that of the white man. It was the instant that Diana had awaited. She stepped in closer, there was the sound of a shot, and the renegade collapsed limply in Colby's grasp. Simultaneously, a wild yell arose from below them in the valley. The remaining Indians, almost upon them, were riding in a close mass from the opposite side. What could it be? More Indians? Colby had hurled the dead chief aside and was on his feet beside the girl. They both looked in the direction of the new sound to see two horsemen racing madly toward them.
"It's Bull! It's Bull!" cried Diana Henders. "Bull and Texas Pete!"
The ponies of the oncoming men were racing neck and neck. Their riders were howling like demons. The Indians heard, paused in their charge, and wheeled to one side. There were five of them left. The reinforcements were too much for them, and with a parting volley they galloped off. But Bull and Texas Pete were of no mind to let them go so easily. For a mile or more they pursued them, until they realized that their already almost spent horses could not outdistance the mounts of the Indians. Then they turned and loped slowly back toward the three upon the hillock. Instantly the immediate necessity of defense had passed, Diana Henders kneeled beside her father and lifted his head in her arms. Colby stepped to the opposite side of the prostrate man to help her. Suddenly she looked up into his eyes, an expression of horror in hers.
"Oh, Hal, Hal, he's gone," she cried, and burying her face in her arms, burst into tears.
The man, unaccustomed to a woman's tears, or a sorrow such as this, was at a loss for words, yet almost mechanically his arms went about her and drew her close to him, so that she stood with her face buried in the hollow of his shoulder as Bull and Texas Pete rode up the hill and dismounted beside them. They took in the pitiful scene at a glance, but they saw more in it than the death of the old man, whom they both loved. At least Bull did. In the attitude of Diana and Colby, he read the death knell of whatever faint hope he might have entertained of ultimate happiness. It was a hurt and bitter man that lifted the dead body of his employer in strong arms and laid it across the saddle of his horse. "You ride Pete's horse, miss," he said gently. "Colby, you walk ahead with her. Pete and I'll come along with the old man." They all did as he bid, without question. There was something about the man that demanded obedience, even if he was no longer foreman. It was always that way with Bull. Wherever he was the leader. Even though men mistrusted or disliked him, and many did, they involuntarily obeyed him, possibly because he was a strong man who thought quickly and accurately and was almost invariably right in his decision. It was certainly not because a large proportion of them loved him, for they did not. There was that something lacking in Bull, that quality which attracted the love of his fellows. After Diana and Colby had gone ahead, Bull and Pete roped the body of Elias Henders securely to the saddle, and presently the sorrowful little cortege took its slow way back toward camp. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 7. Exit Wainwright. A week or 10 days after Elias Henders' funeral, the Wainwright buckboard drew into the Bar Y Ranch, and the Wainwrights, senior and junior, alighted and approached the house. They found Diana in the office working on the books, which she had kept for her father when they were without a bookkeeper, which was the case at present. She greeted them politely, but without marked cordiality. It was the first time that she had encountered either of them since her father's death, having refused to see the younger man on her return to the camp with Elias Henders' body.
"We've been calculating to drive over for several days past, Miss Henders," said the elder man. "Thought maybe you might want some advice or something. Anything we can do, we're both at your service." "That's very kind of you, indeed, I'm sure," replied the girl. "But really, I have so many good friends here that I couldn't think of inconveniencing you. Everyone has been so kind and considerate." "Well, there ain't no harm in offering," he continued. "Anything we can do, you know. If it's a little matter of money to tide you over till the estate's settled, why, just call on Jefferson Wainwright. He's got a lot, and he ain't stingy either."
"There is nothing, thank you," she said, with just the faintest tinge of asperity.
He rose slowly from the chair and shoved his fat hands in his pockets.
"I reckon I'll walk around a bit," he said. "I calculate that you young folks got something to say to one another."
And he winked ponderously at them as he waddled through the doorway. There was a strained silence for several minutes after he left. Jefferson Wainwright, Jr., finally, after clearing his throat two or three times, broke it.
"The governor means all right," he said. "We'd really like to be of service to you,
and after the talk we had that last night before your father was killed, you know."
"Why, I hoped I might have the right to help you, Diana."
She drew herself up very straight and stiff. "I think we had better forget that, Mr. Wainwright," she said.
"But you promised me an answer," he insisted. "After what happened, I should think you would know what the answer must be without being subjected to the humiliation of being told in words."
"Do you mean that you were blaming me, too, like the men did, for going for help?
You would all have been killed if I hadn't. I think I did just the sensible thing," he concluded, half defiantly.
"Yes, I suppose so," she replied icily. "And Hal Colby did a very silly thing staying and risking his life for Dad and me."
"I think you're mighty unfair, Diana," he insisted. "And the way it turned out only goes to prove that I was right. I met Bull and that Texas person less than halfway to camp and got them there in time."
"If they had been as sensible as you, they would have gone on to camp for more reinforcements, as you did. But like most of our boys out here, Mr. Wainwright, they haven't got much sense, and so they nearly rode their horses down to get to us. Only two of them, remember, after you had told them that we were surrounded by 100 Indians."
"Oh, pshaw, I think you might be reasonable and make some allowance for a fellow," he begged. "I'll admit I was a little excited, and maybe I did do the wrong thing, but it's all new to me out here. I'd never seen a wild Indian before, and I thought I was doing right to go for help."
"Can't you forgive me, Diana, and give me another chance? If you'll marry me, I'll take you away from this godforsaken country, back where there are no Indians."
"Mr. Wainwright, I have no wish to offend you, but you might as well know once for all that if you were the last man on earth, I would never marry you. I could not marry a coward, and you are a coward. You would be just as much of a coward back east if danger threatened. Some of our boys are from the east.
Hal Colby was born in Vermont, and the day that you ran away was his first experience, too, with hostile Indians. And if you want another reason why I couldn't marry you, the first and biggest reason, I'll give it to you." Her voice was low and level, like her father's had been on the rare occasions that he had been moved by anger, but the tone was keen-edged and cutting. "I feel now, and I shall always feel, as long as I live, that if you had remained instead of running away, we might have held them off, and Dad would not have been uselessly sacrificed." She had risen while she spoke, and he rose too, standing silently for a moment after she had concluded. Then he turned and walked toward the door. At the threshold he paused and turned toward her. "I hope you will never regret your decision," he said. The tone seemed to carry a threat. "I assure you that I shall never. Good day, Mr. Wainwright." After he had gone, the girl shuddered and sank down into a chair. She wished Hal Colby was there. She wanted someone to comfort her and to give her that sense of safety under masculine protection that her father's presence had always afforded.
Why couldn't all men be like Hal and Bull? When she thought of brave men, she always thought of Bull, too. How wonderful they had all been that day, Hal and Bull and Pete. Rough, uncouth they often were, worn and soiled and careless their apparel, afraid of nothing, man, beast, or the devil, risking their lives joyously, joking with death. And yet they had been as gentle as women when they took her back to camp, and all during the long, terrible journey home, when one of the three had always been within call every minute of the days and nights. Of the three, Bull had surprised her the most, for previously he had always seemed the hardest and the most calloused, and possessing fewer of the finer sensibilities of sympathy and tenderness. But of them all, he had been the most thoughtful and considerate. It had been he who had sent her ahead with Colby that she might not see them lash her father's body to the horse.
It had been he who had covered all that remained of Elias Henders with the slickers from his saddle and Pete's, that she might not be shocked by the sight of her father's body rocking from side to side with the swaying motion of the horse. And it was Bull who had ridden all night to faraway ranches and brought back two buckboards early the next morning to carry her dad and her more comfortably on the homeward journey. He had spoken kindly to her in an altered, softened voice, and he had insisted that she eat and keep her strength when she had wanted to forget food. But the funeral over, she had seen nothing more of him, for he had been sent back to the roundup to ride with it for the last few remaining days, while Hal Colby remained at the ranch to help her to plan for the future and gather together the stray ends that are left flying when even the most methodical of masters releases his grip for the last time.
She sat musing after Wainwright left the room, the clock upon the wall above her father's desk ticking as it had for years, just as though this terrible thing had not happened, just as though her father were still sitting in his accustomed chair instead of lying out there in the sandy, desolate little graveyard above Hendersville, where the rocks that protected the scattered sleepers from the coyotes offered sanctuary to the lizard and the rattlesnake. Her reverie was disturbed by the fall of heavy feet upon the veranda, and she raised her eyes just as the elder Wainwright entered the room. He was not smiling now, nor was his manner so suave as usual. "We got to be going now, Miss Henders," he said brusquely. "But I wanted a mite of a word with you before we left. Of course, you don't know nothing about it. But afore your father died, we was negotiating a deal. He wanted to get out from under, now that the mine's running out, and I wanted to get a range on this side of the mountains. We'd just about got it all fixed up when this accident happened. Now here's what I wanted to say to you. Of course, the mine's no count, and the range is about all fed off, and they ain't scarce enough water for the number of stock I was calculating to put on. But Jefferson Wainwright's a man of his word, and when I says to your father that I'd give him $250,000 for his holdings, even if I don't think they'd be worth so much as that, I'll get all the papers ready so's you won't have to go to no expense for a lawyer, and then you can have the money and go back east to live like you always wanted to, and like your pa was fixing for you." The deeper he got into the subject, the faster he talked, and the more he relapsed into the vernacular of his earlier days. Finally he paused. "What do you say?" he concluded. "The ranch is not for sale, Mr. Wainwright," she replied. He opened his little eyes and his big mouth simultaneously in surprise. "What's that? Not for sale? Why, you must be crazy, child. You don't know what you're talking about." "I know exactly what I am talking about," she told him. "Father talked this all over with me and showed me your offer of $1,000,000 for our holdings. The ranch is not for sale for $1,000,000 or any other price to you, Mr. Wainwright, and be careful that you do not stumble over that stool as you go out." The man's fat face became suddenly empurpled with rage, and for a moment he was inarticulate as, backing toward the doorway, he sought for words adequately to express his outraged feelings. He was not humiliated. There are certain types of men whose thick skin serves them as an invulnerable armor against humiliation. He was just plain mad. Mad all the way through to think that he had been caught at his trickery, exposed and thwarted by a chit of a girl. And, like the type he represented naturally would be, he was mad at her rather than at himself. As he reached the doorway, he found his voice. "You'll be sorry for this! You'll be sorry for this!" he cried, shaking a fist at her. "And mark you, I'll get this property yet. Jefferson Wainwright can buy and sell you 20 times over, and he always gets what he goes after." The figure of a tall man loomed suddenly behind him. Calloused and ungentle fingers seized him roughly by the collar of his coat. A low voice spoke softly in his ear. "Don't you know better'n to shake your fist in the lady's face, you pot-bellied buzzard?" it inquired. And the elder Wainwright was jerked unceremoniously through the doorway, whirled about, and projected violently from the veranda, his speed simultaneously accelerated by the toe of a high-heeled cowboy boot. "I reckon you'd better make yourself damn scarce around here," continued the low tones of the speaker. Wainwright scrambled to his feet and turned upon the owner of the voice. He shook both fists now and fairly danced up and down in his fury. "I'll get you," he screamed. "I'll get you. Don't you know who I am? Why, I could buy and sell you 100,000 times over. I'm Jefferson Wainwright, I am. I'll get you, laying your hands on me, you low-down $35 cowpuncher." "Vamoose," said the man, "and do it pronto." He emphasized his injunction with a shot, the bullet kicking up a little spurt of dust between Wainwright's feet. The fat man started on a run for his buckboard, which the younger Wainwright had driven down to the corrals. The man on the veranda fired again, and again the dust rose about the fleeing feet of the terrified Easterner. Diana Henders had come to the doorway, where she stood leaning against the frame, smiling. "Don't hurt him, Bull," she said. The man cast a quick smile over his shoulder. "I ain't aimin' to hurt him," he said. "I'm just aimin' to educate him. Them corn-fed Easterners ain't got no education nohow. What they need is someone to learn 'em manners." As he spoke, he kept on firing at the fleeing Wainwright, and every shot kicked up a puff of dust close to the fat man's feet until he reached the corner of the bunkhouse and disappeared behind it. The shots had called out the cook and the few men who were about, with the result that a small yet highly appreciative audience witnessed Wainwright's discomfiture. A part of it was Texas Pete, who rocked to and fro in unholy glee. "By gollies, did you see him?" he yelled. "He never hit nothing but the high spots. I bet he busted all the world's records between the office and the bunkhouse. Why, he done it in nothing flat, and you could have played checkers on his coattails. He sure stepped high, wide, and handsome." On the veranda of the ranch house, Bull had shoved his gun back into its holster. The smile had left his face. "I thought you were still out with the outfit, Bull," said the girl. "We finished up last night," he told her, "and I come in ahead.
He looked down at his feet in evident embarrassment. I come in ahead for my time, miss.
Your time? Why, Bull, you're not going to quit.
I reckon I better, he replied. I've been aiming to move on for some spell. The girl's eyes were wide and almost noticeably moist, and there was a surprised, hurt look in them that he caught as he chanced to glance up at her. You see, miss, he hastened to explain, things ain't very pleasant for me here. I ain't complaining, but there are those that don't like me, and I figured I'd quit before I was let out. As long as your pa was alive, it was different, and I don't need to tell you that I'd be powerful proud to work for you always, if there wasn't no one else, but there is. I reckon you got a good man, and it will be pleasanter all around if I ain't here no more.
At the mere thought of his going, a lump rose in Diana Hender's throat, and she realized how much she had come to depend on him. Just the mere fact that she had known Bull was around had given her a feeling of greater security. He had become in the nature of a habit, and it was going to be hard to break that habit.
"Oh, Bull," she cried, "I can't let you go now. I can't spare both you and Dad at the same time. You're like a brother, Bull, and I need a brother mighty badly right now. You don't have to go, do you? You don't really want to."
"No, miss, I don't have to, and I don't want to, if you want me to stay."
"Then you will stay?"
He nodded. "But I reckon you better tell Colby," he said, "for I expect he's aiming to give me my time."
"Oh, no, I'm sure he's not," she cried. "Hal likes you, Bull. He told me you were one of his best friends, and he was so sorry about your losing the job as foreman. He said he hated to take it."
Bull made no comment, and whatever his thoughts, his face did not betray them. Presently he jerked his head in the general direction of the corrals, where the Wainwrights, having hastily clambered into their buckboard, were preparing to depart. "Say the word," he told her, "and I'll run them short sports so far out of the country they won't never find their way back." "No," she said, smiling, "let them go. They'll never come back here, I'm sure."
"I reckon the old gent figures he ain't very popular around these diggings," said Bull, with the faintest trace of a smile. "But I don't know so much about how that young dude stands."
He looked questioningly at Diana.
"About deuce high, Bill," she replied. "I saw enough of him to last me a couple of lifetimes the day the renegades jumped us."
"I reckon as much, miss, knowing you as I do. Scenery and the gift of gab ain't everything, but sometimes they fool women folks, even the brightest of 'em."
"He was awfully good company," she admitted.
"When there weren't no engines around," Bull completed the sentence for her.
"The old feller seemed all het up over something about the time I happened along. I heard him say he was set on getting this property. Is that what they come over for?"
"Yes. He offered me a quarter of what he'd offered Dad for it, and his offer to Dad was only about 20% of what it's worth. You see, Bull, what they want is the mine. They're just using the range and the cattle as an excuse to get hold of the mine because they think we don't know the real value of the diggings. But Dad did know.
There's another vein there that has never been tapped that's richer than the old one. Dad knew about it, and somehow Wainwright learned of it, too."
"The old skunk," muttered Bull. The Wainwrights were driving out of the ranch yard and heading toward Hendersville. The older man was still breathing hard and swearing to himself. The younger was silent and glum. They were going to town for dinner before starting on the long drive back to their ranch. Approaching them along the trail at a little distance ahead was a horseman. Young Wainwright recognized the rider first.
"That's Colby," he said. "He hasn't any use for that fellow Bull. They're both stuck on the girl.
It might not be a bad plan to cultivate him, if you want to get even with Bull." As they came nearer, it appeared evident that Colby was going by them with nothing more than a nod. He did not like either of them, especially the younger, but when they drew rein and the older man called to him, he turned about and rode up to the side of the vehicle.
"You're still foreman here, ain't ye?" asked Wainwright Sr.
Colby nodded.
"Why?"
he inquired. "Well, I just want to tell ye that some of your men ain't got a very pleasant way of treating neighbors."
"How's that?"
"Well, I was just leaving after a social call when one of your men starts shooting at me. That ain't no way to treat friends and neighbors. Suppose we was to shoot up your men when they came over our way."
"Who was it?" demanded Colby.
"Bull," said the younger Wainwright. "I suppose he was drunk again, though. They say he always goes to shooting whenever he gets drunk. When we left, he was up at the house making love to Miss Henders," he added. "I shouldn't think she'd feel safe with a fellow like that around."
Colby scowled. "Thanks for telling me," he said. "I reckon I'll have to fix that feller. He's getting too damn fresh."
"Well, I thought you'd orter know," said Wainwright Sr. "Well, so long, and if ye ever get over our way, drop in."
"Get out," said Jefferson Wainwright Jr., and the two rolled away through the deep dust of the parched road. Colby rode on at a brisk gallop, and as he swung from his saddle, cast a glance in the direction of the house, where he saw Bull just descending the steps from the veranda where Diana Henders stood. Colby bit his lip, and the frown on his face became deeper.
Dragging saddle and bridle from his pony, he turned the animal into the corral with a final slap on the rump, a none too gentle slap which reflected the state of his feelings. Then he headed straight for the bunkhouse, which he reached just in time to intercept Bull at the entrance. "Look here, Bull," said Colby, without any preamble.
This business of drinking and shooting things up has gone about far enough. I ain't going to have it around here no more. I reckon you'd better ask for your time.
All right, said Bull. You go and get it for me while I'm packing my war bag.
Colby, rather surprised and at the same time relieved that Bull took the matter so philosophically, started for the office, while the latter entered the bunkhouse, where Shorty, Texas Pete, and a couple of others who had overheard the conversation outside the door looked up questioningly.
By gollies, exclaimed Texas Pete, I'm a-going to quit. I'm a-going after my time right now, pronto.
And he arose and started for the doorway.
Wait a minute, old hoss, advised Bull. I ain't went yet.
But didn't Colby just let you out? Inquired Pete.
He might change his mind, explained Bull.
Up at the house, Colby was entering the office.
Hello, Di, he cried. Got your checkbook handy?
Yes, why?
Bull's quittin'.
Quitting?
Why, he just promised me that he'd stay on.
I don't understand.
He just promised you that he'd stay on? You mean you asked him to?
Yes, replied Diana. He came up here to quit. Said he thought he wasn't wanted anymore, and I made him promise he wouldn't leave. And I tell you, Hal, we could never replace him. Are you sure he was in earnest about quitting? Send him up here and I'll make him stay.
Well, like as not, I was mistaken, said Colby. I reckon Bull was just a kiddin'. I'll ask him again, and if he's plumb set on leaving, I'll send him up.
When he entered the bunkhouse a few minutes later, he nodded at Bull.
You can stay on if you want to, he said. I've changed my mind.
Bull winked at Texas Pete, who was vainly endeavoring to remember another verse of the seemingly endless self-glorification of the bad hombre.
By gollies, he exclaimed, I believe I've got another.
He twirls two big guns and he shoots out a light. The fellows a-drinkin' their ducks out of sight. He shoots through a bottle that stands on the bar and shoots the old ashes plumb off my cigar. But it seems like I'd left out something that already gone before.
Nobody'd get sore if you left it all out, Shorty assured him.
The trouble with you uneducated cowpunchers, Texas Pete told him, is that you are too all-fired ignorant to appreciate my efforts to elevate you all by means of good poetry. It sure is hell to be the only literary gent in a bunch of roughnecks.
Come, set up the bottles, you gall-darned galoot, says he to the boss, for I opens your snoot with one of these here little babies of mine, and shoots out the no in the no-credit sign.
End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 8. You Don't Dare. The stage lurched down the steep and tortuous gradient of Hell's Bend Pass, bumped through a ruddy gap at the bottom, and swung onto the left fork just beyond. The right fork was the regular stage route to Hendersville. The left-hand road led to town, too, but over Bar Y property and past the home ranch. The driver never came this way unless he had passengers, express or important messages for the ranch, though the distance was no greater and the road usually in better repair. Today he had a telegram for Diana Henders. There was a brief pause as he drew up his sweating team in the road before the ranch house, yelled to attract the attention of a ranch hand working about the corrals, tossed the envelope into the road, and then, with the crack of his long whip, was off again at a run, leaving billowing clouds of powdery dust in his wake. The man working in the corrals walked leisurely into the road, picked up the envelope, and, after scrutinizing the superscription and deciphering it laboriously, carried the message to the office, where Diana Henders was working over the books.
"Telegram for ye, miss," announced the man, crossing the room to hand it to her.
She thanked him and laid the envelope on the desk beside her as she completed an interrupted footing. The arrival of telegrams was no uncommon occurrence, even on that faraway ranch, and as they always pertained to business, they caused Diana no flurry of excitement.
Buyers often wired, while Uncle John Mantle used the comparatively new telegraph facilities upon the slightest pretext.
The footing finally checked to her satisfaction, Diana picked up the envelope, opened it, and drew forth the message. At first she glanced at it casually, then she read it over again with knit brows, as though unable fully to grasp the purport of its contents. Finally she sat staring at it with wide, strained eyes, until, apparently crushed, she lowered her head upon her arms and broke into sobs, for this is what she had read. Miss Diana Henders, Bar Y Ranch, Hendersville, via Aldea, Arizona. Mr. Mantle died suddenly last night. Miss Mantle and I leave for ranch soon as possible after funeral. Morris B. Corson.
For a long time, Diana Henders sat with her face buried in her arms. Gradually, her sobs subsided as she gained control of herself. Stunning though the effect of this new blow was, yet she grasped enough of what it meant to her to be almost crushed by it. Though she had not seen her Uncle John Mantle since childhood, he had, nevertheless, constituted a very real and potent force in her existence. Her mother had adored him, her only brother, and Elias Henders had never ceased to proclaim him as the finest type of honorable gentleman that nature might produce.
His Eastern connections, his reputation for integrity, and his fine business acumen had all been potent factors in the success of the Henders and Mantle partnership. With the death of her father, the girl had felt keenly only her personal loss, for Uncle John Mantle loomed as a rock of Gibraltar to protect her in all matters of business, but now she was absolutely alone. There was no one to whom she might turn for counsel or advice now that these two were gone. Hal Colby, she realized keenly, was at best only a good cowman. In matters requiring executive ability or large financial experience, he was untried. Of Corson, Mantle's attorney, she knew nothing, but she was reasonably sure that even though he proved honest and possessed of an excellent understanding of matters pertaining to the Eastern Office, he would not be competent to direct the affairs of ranch and mine at the sources of production. That she might have carried on herself under the guidance of John Mantle, she had never doubted, since she could always have turned to him for advice in matters of moment where she was doubtful of her own judgment, but without him she questioned her ability to direct the destinies of this great business with all its numerous ramifications. Suddenly she arose and replaced the books in the office safe, dabbed at her tear-dimmed eyes with her handkerchief, and, putting on her sombrero, walked from the office, adjusting her wavy hair beneath the stiff band of her heavy hat. Straight toward the corrals she made her way. She would saddle Captain and ride out into the sunshine and the fresh air, where, of all other places, she knew she might find surcease of sorrow and an opportunity to think out her problems more clearly. As she entered the corral, Hal Colby came running up from the bunkhouse. He had seen her pass and followed her. "Ridin', Di?" he asked. She nodded affirmatively. She was not sure that she wanted company, not even that of Hal Colby, today when she desired to be alone with her grief. "You weren't going alone, were you?" "You know it ain't safe, Di. Your dad wouldn't have let you, and I certainly won't." She made no reply. She knew that he was right. It was not safe for her to ride alone, but today she felt that she did not care what happened to her. Fate had been cruel. There was little more that it could do to harm her. In a way, she half resented Hal's new air of proprietorship, and yet there was something about it that carried a suggestion of relief from responsibility. Here there was at least someone who cared, someone upon whose broad shoulders she might shift a portion of her burden, and so she did not follow her first impulse to send him back. Together they rode from the corral, turning down the road toward town, and neither spoke for several minutes, after the manner of people accustomed to being much together in the saddle. The man, as was usual with him when they rode, watched her profile as a lover of art might gloat over a beautiful portrait, and as he looked at her he realized the change that had come over her face and noted the reddened lids. "What's the matter, Di?" he asked presently. "You look like you've been crying. What's happened?" "I just got a telegram from New York, Hal," she replied. "Uncle John is dead. He died night before last. The stage just brought the message in from Aldea." "Shucks," he said, at a loss for the proper words, and then, "That's sure too bad, Di." "It leaves me all alone now, Hal," she continued, "and I don't know what I'm going to do."
"You ain't all alone, Di. There ain't anything I wouldn't do for you. You know I love you, Di. Won't you marry me? It would make it easier all around for you if we was married. There's them that's always trying to take advantage of a girl or a woman what's left alone. But if you've got a husband, you got someone to look out for you and your rights. I got a little money saved up."
"I have plenty of money, Hal."
"I know it. I wish you didn't have none. It makes me feel like you thought that's what I was after, but it ain't. Won't you, Di? Together we could run the ranch just like your dad was here."
"I don't know, Hal. I don't know what to do. I think I love you, but I don't know. I don't even know that I know what love is."
"You'd learn to love me," he told her, "and you wouldn't have to worry no more. I'd look after everything. Say yes, won't you?"
The temptation was great, greater even than the man himself realized, to have a place to lay her tired head, to have a strong man to carry the burden and the responsibilities for her, to have the arm of love about her as it had been all her life until her father had been taken away. She looked up at him with a faint smile.
"I won't say yes, yet," she said. "Wait a while, Hal. Wait until after Mr. Corson and my cousin come, and we see how things are going to turn out, and then I think that I shall say yes."
He leaned toward her impulsively and put an arm about her, drawing her toward him with the evident intention of kissing her, but she pushed him away. "Not yet, Hal," she told him. "Wait until I've said yes." A week later, a group of boarders were lounging on the veranda of the Donovan House in Hendersville. It was almost supper time of a stage day, and the stage had not yet arrived. Mac Harbor, whose wound had given more trouble than the doctor had expected, was still there convalescing, and Mary Donovan was, as usual, standing in the doorway joining in the gossip and the banter.
"Bill ain't never late unless something's wrong," said Mrs. Donovan.
"Like as not he's been held up again," suggested Mac.
"I'd like to be sheriff of this year county for about a week," stated Wildcat Bob.
"Sure, and what would you be after doing?"
inquired Mary Donovan, acidly. Wildcat Bob subsided, mumbling in his stained beard. For the moment he had forgotten that Mrs. Donovan was among those present. "Here they come," announced Mac. With the clank of chain, the creaking of springs, and the rapid pounding of galloping hooves, the stage swung into the single street of Hendersville in a cloud of dust, and with a final shrieking of protesting brakes pulled up before the Donovan house.
"Where's Gum Smith?" demanded Bill Gatlin from the driver's seat.
"Dunno. Held up again?" asked one of the loungers.
"Yes," snapped Gatlin.
Mac Harbor had risen from his chair and advanced to the edge of the veranda. "The Black Coyote?" he asked. Gatlin nodded.
"Where's that damn sheriff?" he demanded again.
"He ain't here, and he wouldn't be no good if he was," replied Wildcat Bob.
"We don't need no sheriff for what we oughter do," announced Mac Harbor, angrily.
"How's that?" asked Wildcat.
"You don't need no sheriff for a necktie party," said Mac, grimly.
"No, but you gotta get your man first."
"That's plumb easy."
"How come?" inquired Wildcat.
"We all know who the Black Coyote is," stated Mac. "All we gotta do is get a rope and go get him."
"Meanin' get who?" insisted the little old man.
"Why, gosh all hemlock, you know as well as I do that it's Bull," replied Mac.
"I dunno nothing of the kind, young feller," said Wildcat Bob. "Nor neither do you. If you got proof of what you say, I'm with ye. If you ain't got proof, I'm agin ye."
"Don't Bull always wear a black silk handkerchief?" demanded Mac.
"Well, so does the Black Coyote, and they both got scars on their chins. There ain't no doubt of it."
"So you want to string up Bull because he wears a black bandana and a scar, eh? Well, you ain't going to do nothing of the kind while Wildcat Bob can fan a gun. Get proof on him, and I'll be the first to put a rope around his neck. But you got to get more proof than a black handkerchief."
"Sure, and for once you're right, you old blatherskite," commended Mary Donovan. "Be after coming to your suppers now, the all of yous, and forget stringing up decent young men like Bull.
Sure, and I don't believe he ever held up nothing at all. He's that nice to me whenever he's here, with his Mrs. Donovan, mum. This and his Mrs. Donovan, mum. That, and a fetching wood for me, which the likes of none of yees ever did. The very idea of him being the Black Coyote. Go on, would ye?"
"Well, we all know that Gregorio's one of them, anyway. We might string him up," insisted Mac.
"We don't know that neither," contradicted Wildcat. "But when it comes to stringing up Gregorio or any other greaser, I'm with ye. Go out and get him, Mac, and I'll help you string him up."
A general grin ran around the table, for of all the known bad men in the country, the Mexican, Gregorio, was by far the worst. To have gone out looking for him and to have found him would have been equivalent to suicide for most men, and though there were many men in the county who would not have hesitated had necessity demanded, the fact remained that his hiding place was unknown, and that that fact alone would have rendered an attempt to get him a failure.
"There's only one way to get him, sonny," continued Wildcat Bob, "and that is to put a man on the stage with a bullion, instead of a kid."
Mac flushed. "You was there when they got me," he fired back. "You was there with two big six guns, and what did you do, eh? What did you do?"
"I wasn't hired to guard no bullion, and I wasn't sitting on the box with no sawed-off shotgun across my knees, neither. I was a-riding inside with a lady. What could I have done?"
He looked around at the others at the table for vindication.
"Ye couldn't done nothing, ye," said Mary Donovan, "without a cord of barbed wire inside ye and some poor innocent tenderfoot to shoot the heels off on."
Wildcat Bob fidgeted uneasily and applied himself to his supper, pouring his tea into his saucer, blowing noisily upon it to cool it, and then sucking it through his whiskers with an accompanying sound not unlike snoring, but later he was both mollified and surprised by a second generous helping of dessert. When word of the latest holdup reached the Barwy Ranch, it caused the usual flurry of profanity and speculation. It was brought by a belated puncher who had ridden in from the West Ranch by way of Hendersville. The men were gathered at the evening meal, and of a sudden a silence fell upon them as they realized, apparently simultaneously and for the first time, that there was a single absentee. The meal progressed in almost utter silence then, until they had reached the pudding, when Bull walked in, dark and taciturn, and with the brief nod that was his usual greeting to his fellows. The meal continued in silence for a few minutes, until the men who had finished began pushing back their plates preparatory to rising.
"I reckon you know the stage was held up again, Bull, and the bullion stolen," remarked Hal Colby, selecting a toothpick from the glassful on the table.
"How should I know it?" asked Bull. "Ain't I been up Sinkhole Canyon all day? I ain't seen no one since I left the ranch this morning."
"Well, it was," said Colby. "The same two slick gents done it, too."
"Did they get much?" asked Bull.
"It was a big shipment," said Colby. "It always is. They don't never touch nothing else, and they seems to know when we're shipping more'n ordinary. Looks suspicious."
"Did you just discover that?" inquired Bull.
"No, I discovered it a long time ago, and it may help me to find out who's doing it." Well, I wish you luck, and Bull resumed his meal.
Colby, having finished, rose from the table and made his way to the house. In the cozy sitting room, he found Diana at the piano, her fingers moving dreamily over the ivory keys.
"Some more bad news, Di," he announced. She turned wearily toward him. "What now?" "The black coyote again. He got the bullion shipment."
"Was anyone hurt?"
"No," he assured her. "I am glad of that. The gold is nothing. I would rather lose it all than have one of the boys killed. I have told them all, just as Dad did, to take no chances. If they could get him without danger to themselves, I should be glad, but I could not bear to have one of our boys hurt for all the gold in the mine."
"I think the black coyote knows that," he said, "and that's what makes him so all-fired and nervy. He's one of our own men, Di, can't you see it? He knows when the shipments are big and don't never touch a little one, and he knows your dad's orders about not taking no chances. I've hated to think it, but there ain't no other two ways about it. It's one of our men, and I wouldn't have to walk around the world to put my finger on him, neither."
"I don't believe it," she cried. "I don't believe that one of my men would do it."
"You don't want to believe it, that's all. You know just as well as I do who's doing it, down in the bottom of your heart." "I don't like to believe it no more'n you do, Di, but I ain't blind, and I hate to see you being made a fool of and robbed into the bargain. I don't believe you'd believe it, though, if I caught him in the act."
"I think I know whom you suspect, Hal," she replied, "but I'm sure you're wrong."
"Will you give me a chance to prove it?"
"How?"
"Send him up to the mine to guard the bullion until Mac gets well, and then keep Mac off the job for a month," he explained. "I'll bet my shirt that either there ain't no hold-ups for a month, or else there's only one man pulls him off instead of two. Will you do it?"
"It isn't fair. I don't even suspect him."
"Everybody else does, and that makes it fair, for it gives him a chance to prove it if he ain't guilty."
"It wouldn't prove anything, except that there were no hold-ups while he was on duty."
"It would prove something to my mind if they started up again pretty soon after he was taken off the job," he retorted.
"Well, it might, but I don't think I'd ever believe it of him unless I saw him with my own eyes."
"Pshaw, the trouble with you is you're soft on him. You don't care if your gold is stole if he gets it."
She drew herself to her full height.
"I do not care to discuss the matter further," she said. "Good night."
He grabbed his hat viciously from the piano and stamped towards the doorway. There he turned about and confronted her again for a parting shot before he strode out into the night.
"You don't dare try it," he flung at her. "You don't dare."
After he had gone, she sat biting her lip, half in anger and half in mortification. But after the brief tempest of emotion had subsided, she commenced to question her own motives impartially. Was she afraid? Was it true that she did not dare? And long after she had gone to bed, and sleep would not come, she continued thus to catechize herself. As Hal Colby burst into the bunkhouse and slammed the door behind him, the sudden draft thus created nearly extinguished the single lamp that burned upon an improvised table at which four men sat at poker. Bull and Shorty, Texas Pete, and one called Idaho sat in the game.
"I raise you $10, remarked Idaho, softly, as the lamp resumed functioning after emitting a thin, protesting spiral of black soot.
"I see that and raise you my pile," said Bull, shoving several small stacks of silver toward the center of the table.
"How much you got there?" inquired Idaho, the others having dropped out.
Bull counted. "There's your 10," he said, "and here's 10, 15, 25, he continued, counting in a monotone. 96, he announced. "I raise you $96, Idaho."
"I ain't got $96, said Idaho. "I only got 8.
"You got a saddle, ain't you?" inquired Bull sweetly.
"And a shirt," suggested Texas Pete.
"My saddle's worth $350 if it's worth a cent," proclaimed Idaho.
"No one ain't never said it was worth a cent," Shorty reminded him.
"I'll cover it and call you," announced Bull. "I don't want your shirt, Idaho. It's full of holes."
"What you covering it with?" asked Idaho. "I don't see nothing."
Bull rose from the table. "Wait a second," he said, and stepped to his blankets where he rummaged for a moment in his war bag. When he returned to the table, he tossed a small buckskin bag among his silver. "There's $500 worth of dust in that," he said. "If you win, we can weigh out what's coming to you over at the office tomorrow morning."
Hal Colby looked on, an interested spectator. The others fell silent. Texas Pete knit his brows in perplexity.
"Let's see it," demanded Idaho.
Bull picked up the bag, opened it, and poured a stream of yellow particles into his palm.
"Satisfied?" he inquired.
Idaho nodded.
"What you got?" demanded Bull.
Idaho laid 4 kings on the table, smiling broadly.
4 aces," said Bull, and raked in the pot.
"Why didn't you raise him?" demanded Shorty.
"I just told you I didn't want his shirt," said Bull, "and I don't want your saddle neither, kid. I'll keep the money. It ain't good for kids like you to have too much money, but you keep the saddle."
"I'm going to turn in," said Shorty, pushing back and rising.
"You'd all better turn in and give someone else a chance to sleep," said the foreman. "What with your damn game and Pete's singing, a feller ain't got no more chance of sleeping around here than a jackrabbit.
Why don't you fellers crawl in?"
"Crawl in, crawl in," exclaimed Texas Pete. "Crawl in, crawl out. By gollies, I got another verse."
The boss, he crawls out then, all shaky and white, from under the bar where he's been sitting tight. "Now set out the pizen right pronto, you coot," the stranger remarks, "or I sure starts to shoot. I only been practicing so far," says he. "A barkeep or two don't mean nothing to me. Most Alice I had one for breakfast each day. I don't mean no harm, it's just only my way."
End of chapter 8.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tricolor variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.